Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Cohen Esri Apartment Investors Podcast. My name is Ryan Huffman. I am Cohen Esri's Chief Operating Officer. I am joined today by Phil Melton, the Managing Director of Cohen Esri Capital Partners, our capital formation unit, and Matt Von Indy, our Vice President of Acquisition in the Apartment Investors Unit. Welcome to the podcast, folks. So today we're going to dive into a hot topic, mezzanine and preferred financing, which is going to be a lively topic based on what we heard at NMHC. So let's lead off. Phil, why don't you take a moment to introduce yourself to the audience and give a little bit of your background?
Sure. Thanks, Ryan. I was a mortgage banker for 27 years or so, and Cohen Esri was a client of mine, and I joined them a couple of years ago to help spearhead their capital formations group. Have been involved with multifamily sort of financing for that whole entire period of time, probably between direct production and overseeing other people have done, $10 billion plus worth of commercial real estate financing in my career.
Awesome. So let's dive in and kind of start pretty basic. So Phil and Matt, I want you guys to talk a little bit about this concept of mezzanine, and I'm going to call it slash pref financing, because there's kind of different vehicles that go into that. What are the products and what are the differences in the products? Phil, you want to start us off and then we'll kick it to Matt?
Sure. Well, I think, mezzanine debt is kind of, as the name mentions, is a debt sort of a product. Both of them kind of fill a missing middle as it relates to the capital stack. So you normally have first lien debt, you have common equity, and then oftentimes there's a need for a middle piece of financing in order to make the capital stack work, in order when you're putting a deal together. And so what we're talking about here is mezzanine debt or preferred equity. Mezzanine debt truly is a debt product. It's structured as debt. It typically sits behind the first lien mortgage. It can sometimes have a second lien on the property if the first lien lender will allow it to do so. There's an intercreditor agreement between the mezzanine lender and the first lien lender, whereas pref equity truly feels a little more like equity in the sense that the ability for the pref equity to take a position in the transaction is much more at the ownership level as opposed to the property level where mezzanine debt normally sits. But both of them serve similar capacity in terms of filling out that middle piece of the capital stack between first lien debt and common equity in a transaction.
Matt, you want to take and go a little bit deeper on some of the products?
Sure. Yeah, that's actually a really great way to frame that. So mezzanine debt and preferred equity are similar in that they both sit between the senior debt and the common equity in the stack. Functionally, they serve basically to fill a gap in funding or to provide more leverage, however you want to think about it. The main difference between the two is, like Phil was saying, it's mezzanine debt, as the name implies, is structured as a loan. And it's secured, being a loan, secured via a lien on the real estate, on the property. While preferred equity, is an equity investment who often just holds a stake in the property-owning entity. So they're structured and secured differently, but functionally, they are very similar.
So these products, they've come into focus a lot in the last 12 months. And when we were at NMHC, it was interesting to hear a lot of the large equity players had flipped some of their funds from, let's call it JV equity funds, to pref. Matt, what's driving folks to do that? And what's driving operators like us to look at those products? What are the fundamentals that are really driving that, I think?
Fundamentals are, I think you're seeing, in light of the interest rate environment, sort of a historic rise of 2,000% in basically a year and a half to 2 years in the federal funds rate, equity groups are just reconfiguring their risk profiles. So what that means for us is we have yet an additional tool in the tool belt to use to fill out, to borrow Phil's phrase, to sort of fill out that missing middle on transactions. We are definitely seeing, and Phil can speak to this more than us, I think, because he deals with these people literally on a daily basis, but there is just predominance of pref equity offerings.
Yeah, and I think, look, a lot of the reasons why people are looking at it is, one, because of the shift from JV equity to a desire for pref from investors. And why are investors doing that is, previously, we might be looking at a return on one of our value add acquisitions in a 14 to 16% IRR for an investor. That was when rates were down, as low as they were, to Matt's point, before the run-up in long-term and short-term rates that we've seen over the past couple of years. Now, because pref and mez have a tendency to price in the low teens to mid-teens sort of return, so call it, 12 to 15%, investors are starting to take a look at it and say, well, I can be in a superior position to the common equity. I don't have to take JV risk. as it relates to the upside and being able to be able to generate, you know, 20 plus returns, I can go ahead and put pref equity out at a 15 return, which is what they used to be able to get on a value add proposition. So from their perspective, by sitting in a piece of the stack that to them is superior to the common equity, they can get the same sort of returns and they're not leveraging as high, because typically most pref or mezz is only willing to go to, you know, call it 80 to 90% loan to cost in general, as opposed to on a JV structure, those equity investors are last dollars in conjunction with the GP. They're able to take basically, they'll get the same sort of returns for less risk in a superior position, which is why the investors are pushing to that sort of a metric as opposed to our avenue of financing, as opposed to kind of joint venture equity. When rates start to come down and they can't get those same sorts of yield, my hunch is we'll start seeing some shift back to JV equity opportunities when they're looking to create more opportunistic yield.
So Ryuka, let's talk a little bit about this concept, which is the whole extend and pretend, which is where we're at right now. Are you seeing these products really coming in mainly for that reason, where you've got loans that are maturing, maybe variable rate loans, and we're kicking the can down the road, and this is how we're doing it?
So I think it's a couple of different things. One is extend and pretend is one, and then the other is, oftentimes, to your point, you just mentioned it, on floating rate, those interest rate caps that were originally bought by the borrowing entity at the time the deal closed are beginning to expire. And the cost to buy caps today have excessively grown to the same point that Matt was talking about, rates, you know, 2,000% increase. Well, rate caps have gone up. And oftentimes, to make the deals work, you have to buy what's called an in-the-money cap, which means today's rate on SOFR might be 530. But you need to buy a SOFR rate at 350 in order to make the deal work. Well, that means you're buying an in-the-money rate interest rate cap. And with that being the case, it becomes costly, very costly, because you're effectively, you know that counterparty to you has to start making payments day one. That's where pref equity starts to come into play. The extend and pretend is a situation where you have to have a cash in, sort of a refi or a deleveraging of the position to satisfy the lender, and the lender then will extend the loan, but you have to put more capital up. Or the case is where you're buying an interest rate cap and you need substantial dollars. We're talking potentially multiple millions of dollars to be able to buy rate caps on these large transactions. And so pref equity is stepping into that position to be able to satisfy that requirement until such time that the deal can need to be refinanced and they can pay it all off, or they're at a point to where it makes more sense to sell the asset.
Matt, talk a little bit about how we at CEAI view these products. We've used them. We don't have a lot of them. I don't think we have any in position right now, but we have used them in the past. But talk about the pros and cons we see with products.
So we just have one remaining. I think it's been really limited when we've opted to utilize the products. Actually, at a local deal here in our headquarters market of Kansas City, we still have one with a rather large institutional equity and debt firm, I should say. But to the main point of your question, I think the easiest and clearest way to think about both of these, sort of as we elaborated on before in the podcast, is by viewing them as alternatives to piecing together capital stacks. When the more traditional or more vanilla 65-35 or 70-30 ratio, you know, senior debt to common equity ratio isn't available on a given transaction. So in that vein, they're just extra tools in the tool belt. So for the folks listening, like me, who might be more visual learners, it makes sense to think of a capital stack kind of like a pyramid with different levels. As we move from the base of the pyramid upward toward whatever that's called, the capstone, the pinnacle, we see the size of the checks get smaller and the priority stake to cash flow become more subordinate to the previous level. And then we see higher risk profiles increase and increasing return thresholds in tandem. So when you think of it this way, it's rather intuitive. Generally, the main pro here is that, you know, both mezz and pref, they provide sponsors like us additional options to move forward in piecing together the required capital for a deal that we truly believe in, and this is important, at a lower cost than common equity. So the pros of the mezzanine and pref equity firms for them is that, you know, pref gets a more secured position than common equity, closer to the front of the line, and mezzanine debt gets a higher premium than senior debt due to being subordinate to it or behind the line in the capital flows. So on top of that, I'd also add, you know, and this is perhaps from a higher vantage point rather than related to our own company's growth, rather than focusing in simply at the deal level or on completing a single transaction, that an additional pro is that utilizing pref equity enables us to get our foot in the door with equity firms that perhaps we haven't yet transacted with, but with whom we do hope to develop you know, a longer term JV equity relationship. So in other words, pref equity can be a solid entree into a JV equity relationship. So those are the pros. The primary con, and it's also, you know, an obvious one, is that, you know, both mezzanine debt and preferred equity, while less expensive than the common equity, they often function as debt. And this is what Phil was talking about earlier. So this means that they weigh down the distributable cash flows to common equity, and in our case, you know, to GP co-investors. This pushes back the returns and could sometimes require a stronger need for appreciation, perhaps, in order to hit yield requirements, you know, for common equity. So another con, and this is ultra relevant these days, and we've all been reading about it in the financial news, is that sometimes when the market is ultra hot, like it was in the post-COVID recovery, people fall into the trap of forgetting that just because there are certain tools in the tool belt, it doesn't mean that it's always prudent to use them. So in other words, it's super important to weigh the pros and cons and avoid embarking on over-layered capital stacks that might overburden a deal, you know, when the investment projections don't work out according to the original plan or pro forma.
So one thing to add to that too, if I can real quickly, is Matt made a good point. The decrease in distributable cash, yet at the same time, typically because they don't go as high up the curve, there's more co-invest that's required by a general partner acquiring the deal. And as such, we're waiting longer and longer as a sponsor for our potential returns, because there's likely not cash flow, which puts it, you know, most of the time the pref and the mezz have some sort of current pay mechanism that can oftentimes take up a majority of the cash flow. And that means that the GP is basing most, if not all, of their return on the exit. So it pushes back and creates more back-end risk to the GP, but we're also putting more dollars into individual transactions. So if you're looking to leverage your balance sheet or leverage your fund or leverage your co-investment capital, just realize you're going to put more money in the deals with pref or mezz than you will on a deal with the JV equity partnership.
And I think all those are great points. And Matt, you said something I think is highly beneficial for folks. If you're developing your track record, we have found and we have heard from folks that a lot of times you may have to do a few of these pref structures in order to get your foot in the door. More advantageous structures come as you execute your business plans and prove out that track record. But I think these are products that, you're right, allow folks to get their foot in the door with a new equity group. Phil, are there instances where these products make more sense and instances where they make less sense as folks were analyzing the products?
Well, I think, you know, and I don't want to get too far ahead of myself, but certain lenders prefer different sort of structures. So some of it depends on who your first lien is. Preferred equity has seemingly become a little bit more in favor than mezz, especially if you're related, if you're doing an agency transaction, Fannie or Freddie. And the rationale behind that is because the mezzanine is taking a debt position behind it and have some ability to create foreclosures in the event of a non-payment on the mezz, that can sometimes run into conflict with Fannie and Freddie requirements. Whereas pref equity, you know, in the case of that, two things happen. One is, in the event that something goes wrong, they have the ability to step into the partnership and correct it and right the ship. But from a sponsor perspective, in mezzanine, they can foreclose out the sponsor in such a way they would wipe out the entire investment. Whereas on a preferred equity, if they do step in, you know, effectively the common equity isn't wiped out until and unless there's a disposition, in which case there's not enough proceeds to pay back the common equity, but at least you have a chance to get some of your equity back. So, you know, when I look at the optionality here, first thing I look at is with my debt product, with my first lien product, and what will they accommodate as it relates to mezzanine or pref. I can say right now, there is a lot more interest in the pref side than there is in the mezzanine side, both from an investor and from a lender perspective. I think, you know, that could change as time goes on, because in previous time, mezzanine was looked at more favorably. From our perspective, there seems to be a more alignment of interest when you have a pref equity partner who can step into the deal, but then still protects your position to the extent possible. So if I'm sitting there looking at it and looking at them side by side, I'm likely saying I prefer a pref equity group that is likely to work with me in trying to solve a problem rather than looking at potentially a foreclosure mechanism that could wipe out my position in whole.
I mean, all of that absolutely makes sense. And so let's take another question here, which I'm going to throw to Matt. We've talked about the pros and cons of the products. What are some of the nuances that folks should pay very close attention to when they're evaluating the products themselves?
That's a great, actually, I love the way that this is sort of naturally just segued and flowed, because that's, I think in my own brain, I think of what Phil was just describing as the guardrails, which have to be there really for any sponsor, for any event sponsor. How that translates just in sort of, you know, desk review, day-to-day deal overview, I would say that when they make the most sense is when you have maybe an outsized return on a really, really stellar investment opportunity that you believe in. When they make less sense is, again, when you're really, really struggling to, or squinting, as we say internally, to make sense of a deal that only really comes together once you start adding all these layers of capital. For me, that's just sort of their bare bones, common day way of thinking about it. To your point, your question here, Ryan, I think our mantra comes into play. Our mantra here is risk mitigation. And we are ultra, ultra conservative in our investment approach. This really shines through whenever we have, in limited instances in the past, considered utilizing or mezzanine debt or pref equity. Far more often than not, we opt not to layer it in, like you were saying. Part of this is because we already have longstanding relationships with equity and a really long track record with the agencies, and so we simply haven't needed mezzanine or pref. Another reason is because we are ultra-sensitive, ultra-conservative, and that means that we're ultra-sensitive in stress-testing the cash flows on any given investment opportunity, and naturally, we avoid overburdening a deal to over-leverage so as to prevent a situation, again, like we're seeing in virtually weekly news announcements, to prevent a situation from arising where we're in a position to make a capital call, you know, to go back to investors, to prop up an investment property. So our track record speaks for itself in that regard. I'm really proud to say that we stick to our conservative investment approach as regards to mezz and pref as well.
Yeah, I mean, those are great points. I would throw in a couple of things that we look at that I would caution folks to look at. The first is, what is their pref return and what's the current pay? So typically when you get into this, you have, let's say their pref is at a 15, but they have a current pay at 9. So as you're stressing the cash flow, you'll want to understand, what do I absolutely have to pay them and what am I supposed to pay? And how does that difference, if you're only going to pay the must pay 9%, how does it accumulate? Because there's times that that will accumulate and compound very differently. Most of those structures are going to dovetail in with your first lien position. So they'll quote unquote mature with the first lien, but you're going to want to make sure that you don't have a term on that pref or mezz that is short of what your first mortgage lien holder is. The last thing I would caution is, Phil, you brought this up, and I think it's good to talk about it. Talk to the first lien first before you engage those conversations and make sure you understand what their guardrails are. Because we, as a case study, got into a situation several years ago where we were using one of the crowdfunding platforms as a pref, and the GSE hadn't done a deal with them, and so they had to be vetted, so it took a lot longer to get them convinced, and the documents went through tons of revisions, and we were real close to losing that pref piece. So having those conversations early, those are my tips and tricks. Phil, do you have any additional tips or tricks you want to toss into the
get it? Yeah, I think you hit the biggest one. Make sure your first lien lender has documents. I'd also say is make sure you have an attorney that's familiar with both the lender that you're working with. So if it's Fannie, Freddie, or bank or whatever, then understand what their motivations are and what their attitude is towards it, but also have experience in either negotiating pref or mezzanine loan documents with that provider. Not necessarily they have to know the parties themselves, but they have experience with those sort of products. Because if you get an attorney who's working for you that doesn't have a firm grasp of both sides' needs in trying to effectuate this sort of structure, you could end up paying a substantial amount more in legal fees as they get through the documents. But as importantly, to Ryan said, you run the risk of it taking too long that it you lose the opportunity to close on the transaction. So make sure you have a team that is highly experienced in utilizing, you know, first lien capital structure and whatever subordinate or mezz or pref equity piece that you're doing. That those are kind of the two big things. And then also, if you get an opportunity, is if you're working with somebody, especially in prep, because they have the ability to step in and hopefully protect some of your position in the event something goes wrong, see if you can get some references as to how they behave in the event that something goes wrong, how quick are they to pull the trigger on you? Is it set up so that you can be successful, you have runway, and they trust you as a partner? Is it going to be a situation where if the smallest little thing goes wrong, they're actually looking more for the purposes of taking over the property than they are working with you as a partner? So if you can, get some references from them of other borrowers that they've worked with and get an understanding of how they behave when things aren't perfect, because these deals oftentimes are the period of time or something happens where it's not perfect and you want a partner. You don't want somebody who's trying to loan to own, so to speak, in your capital stack.
And I think that's a great point, and I'll expound on it for just a second, which is stress test that model as much as you can with these products. We've alluded to, and it's true, you know, pref and mez pieces are going to soak up the cash flow. And so, Phil, you brought up a good point. What if stuff doesn't execute perfectly? And in our world, that rarely happens. I mean, you pat yourself on the back when it does happen, but invariably you're going to have to bob and weave, and some blow through projections and some you fall short. When you have these pref and mez pieces, the biggest risk factor you have is that things don't go right and you don't have cash flow to fall back on to kind of absorb that, because it's already spoken for by the pref and mez person. So stress testing those models will show you, if I go off the rails by 5%, then I'm writing checks, or is it 10% or is it 15? Like, how much room and how much margin of safety can you have in the transaction to make sure that the transaction executes? Anything else you guys want to talk about with this pref and mez piece before we wrap up the podcast?
No, I think we covered at least a lot of the high-level basics.
Yeah, I would agree. Well, thank you guys for listening to this podcast. We will see you next time.